much for having me here and getting me grilled. Can I tell you what the myth is before I tell you what the reality is about the proprietor's input? The myth is Rupert Murdoch is a sort of Wizard of Oz type character who pulls vast levers from his office on a very, very tall building in New York, and things happen all the way around the world, not just in his newspapers, but in general elections and corporate decisions. He basically controls the world, certainly controls Britain, is now running the White House as well. Telling them about politics in a way that A, they could digest it and be interested in it, and B, in a way that matters to them, so you know, consumer focus. So when it comes to general elections, referendums, leadership contests, whatever, we try incredibly hard to work out what it is our readers want, what would be best for them in our view, by talking to them, by having our finger on their pulse, and that's what ends up going in the paper, not something set up by the proprietor. There have been times when I know for a fact the proprietor has had views on candidates, the like, that we haven't gone with. We were very critical of Obama not intervening in Syria. We wanted to intervene in Syria. We wanted to fight another war, to put it in that language.
Also, the House of Commons vote against intervening in Syria.
Yeah, which in my view has been one of the greatest mistakes the House of Commons has made this decade. I mean, the price of inaction is arguably, in my view, if you look at the mess of Syria now, greater than the price of action. Well, certainly, there is now a huge debate to be had. So, you know, I wouldn't say we default to whatever the US government wants at all. That's a very wrong conclusion. I think we are pretty Atlanticist in our default setting. You know, we rather like the United States and we think they have a lot of good ideals, but we don't essentially follow the US government at all times at all.
It's one of the great myths that in fact the Sun is a left-wing paper because it's a red top, whereas its history suggests it's probably a bit right-wing.
So, there is that misconception that Red Top, because of the Daily Mirror. The Daily Mirror was, you know, classically, I think it's an older generation.
And the sketch before it.
Yeah, and so Red Tops were left-leaning newspapers before the Sun came on in 1969. And actually, we were the left-leaning newspaper. I can't remember what we did in 1970. I think we backed Heath, but we definitely backed Wilson in both 74. In fact, we backed Wilson in the first 74 election. The second one, I think, we stayed on the fence. The only time the Sun's ever stayed on the fence. Then obviously we backed Thatcher and then Major, and we backed Tony Blair three times. Three different times. So we've actually chopped and changed between left, right and centre.
So is that saying that the readership of the Sun is actually, if you want to test a commercial product, you go to Reading. And if it works in Reading, it will work in England. Is that like saying that the Sun is the barometer of politics in the UK?
Well, that's exactly what we hope to be. Because we think our readers are the barometer of what happens in politics. You know, we've got the most readers, we've got readers who switch their opinions most, who are less or the least politically aligned. So that's precisely where we need to be. It's all about trying to simulate with them.
And if Armageddon came tomorrow and it's all over and we're all finished, and each newspaper gets to select one front page, what do you think the Sun would select?
Of all the Sun front pages over the years?
Politics.
There is one that sticks in my mind, there are so many. There is one that sticks in my mind, my most favourite that I wrote. And it's a slightly churlish one, so I excuse my levity in this. When Gordon Brown lost the 2010 general election, I remember there were about 3 or 4 days of debate about whether or not he would actually relinquish being Prime Minister and leave Number 10, the coalition. Wrangles went on and on, and it wasn't until I think Tuesday. By Monday, we backed David Cameron over Gordon Brown. We were rather fed up with Gordon Brown staying number 10. So by Monday's front page, and also, actually, there was no other political news going on because the coalition talks were going on and on and on. We ended up doing a fantastic front page, squatter in number 10, and a picture of Gordon Brown holding onto the door frame. And the copy went, A 53-year-old Scot was last night holed up in a £3 million Westminster townhouse. Squatting was quite a big thing at the time, and then we wrote it like a straight news story, that there was literally the Scotsman squatting in a Westminster townhouse. He wouldn't get out of it, and it was so disrespectful. But I'm told that was the one thing that flipped Gordon Brown over to thinking, I now need to resign, because the ridicule he was being exposed to, encapsulated by that front page.
Does the Sun think a hard Brexit would be bad for the British economy?
I'm not running away, I promise. Yes. You want a longer answer than that, I imagine?
Yeah.
We have backed Brexit ever since the referendum campaign, as in the newspaper has. I keep my views to myself. How did I vote in the referendum?
Can I just intervene? I think you'd be a brilliant Brexit secretary. Mm-hmm. We've heard he's a supreme politician. But your Prime Minister won't allow you to do it.
Well, I don't.
And I give that as a mark of respect.
And a member of the Labour Party.
And it's a total anti-call.
Let's go back to Dick's question. Andy Gordon, a member of the Labour Party. There's a subject.
Let's take this on, because I defy you to tell me how I voted in any referendum or election campaign.
I don't know.
Thank you very much. We'll come back. We'll come back. But
in a spirit of mutual respect.
Indeed.
Let's go back to Nick's question.
Indeed. I look forward to that. Back to Nick's question. We back Brexit in the referendum campaign, and again, I tip my hat towards the gentleman here, because that's where our readers were. And if you want to be a sensible newspaper and represent people, represent your readers, then 75% of your readers want Brexit, and you're telling them to vote Remain, you're not going to be a very successful commercial product. So, you know, it is that primary reason that we back Brexit. Now, Brexit, during the referendum campaign, this is where the gentleman I may agree a little bit more, was wholly undefined.
Wholly
undefined. Some claim that it was a clear vote to leave the customs union and leave the single market. I think it's hard to do that. So others say it was a clear rejection of freedom of movement. I think it's probably a little easy to do that. But apart from those, you know, vague arguments, nothing about Brexit was defined. And that was purposeful, because the people who ran the Leave campaign the chief executive of the entire Leave campaign, a chap called Matthew Elliott, told me this 6 months beforehand, told me that they were purposely going to keep the entire campaign as vague as possible. For the simple reason they'd seen exactly what happened to Alex Salmond in Scotland for the Scottish referendum. They'd seen him get absolutely filleted on the detail, especially with the currency. What was going to happen to the pound and the Scottish independence. And because he tried to lay out some quite complex plans or complex arguments of what would happen, the British government and the, what they call the No campaign up in Scotland, were able to dissect that and chop it into small pieces. So the Leave campaign said, right, we're not going to make the same, we're going to keep it as vague as possible, keep it all in sentiment and you know, big, bold statements, and not get pinned down in the detail. That way they can't come after us. And the Remain campaign had a terrible disadvantage of having to defend the status quo in granular detail, but totally unable to attack the Leave campaign in any detail at all. So we backed that kind of Brexit. We've also backed Theresa May's Lancaster House speech, which was the ultimate hard Brexit, trick, cake and eat it speech, as if we want everything from Brexit we could possibly get. And since that's proved to be impossible to deliver, we're now backing Chequers. Now, that doesn't mean that we've necessarily changed our views on what type of Brexit we want, although I think the entire country is becoming a lot more educated about the European Union, Brexit and everything else over this, you know, pretty difficult two-year period we're having. It does mean that we recognise the government have pretty badly handled negotiation. There are some major mistakes the government has made, such as getting trapped into the Article 50 process, certainly from the stage it got into. And in our view now, there is little other choice but to stick with the government's plan. There are sort of two reasons for that. One is what the EU are prepared to accept. No deal, you know, I had this debate, but for the benefit of everyone else, no deal, in my view, is completely off the table. It will not happen, it cannot happen, and it's a bit of a joke to pretend it could. The reason being, the British government would not want to bring on what would be a pretty catastrophic economic event, because they know the damage they would do to the Conservative Party long term. It would make Black Tuesday or Black Wednesday, whichever it was. I was in short trousers. Thank you for someone who wasn't in short trousers at the time. It would make Black Wednesday. It would make Brexit look like a walk in the park, in my view. So, but there's another obvious reason, which is that the House of Commons composition, which is basically soft Brexit stroke Remain now, simply would not allow no deal. It will not be allowed to happen because the Commons reject it, they send the government back to Brussels. Theresa May knows that, European Union knows that. So it involves some sort of, you know, compromise or fudge. And at the moment, Chequers is far from perfect, but it's the only thing on the table.
Do you think it was ever realistic, Tom, to negotiate in public?
Yes. because I mean, you have to do that in a democratic country. You have to tell people what you're doing. But I think the problem was you're negotiating in public and making up your script as you go along. You know, this is what the British government that Theresa May started leading had no plan. They didn't know what they wanted out of Brexit. They certainly couldn't agree amongst themselves.
We didn't think it would happen. And if we go back, let me put it to a question to you that goes back into time, that Wilson, who was a very adept politician, probably the first politician to know how to use television, I understand that he was told by the unions if he didn't have a referendum they wanted out of it, then he wouldn't get his cheque for the general election. So he agreed to have one. And it's interesting if you read Barbara Castle and Wedgie Benn at the time on how skillfully he handled it. And if we think to the recent referendum, Cameron was clearly trying to stop UKIP taking seats and so on. Probably didn't expect to actually win and to be pulled back again by the Liberals. But if he did win, he thought, well, we'll win the European referendum anyway. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, very fair. Cameron was a chancer. He was an arrogant chancer. And
can we use that?
I don't think that's a matter
I'm
of...
I'm a member of the Tory party and I agree with you.
Well, there you go. That is not a matter of debate. I think that's an accepted fact. And yeah. I think you'll probably admit that. He fundamentally miscalculated. And yeah. We know that because he lost.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's in Cameron's... Cameron famously went to one of the EU councils just before the referendum to say, look, I'm not going to lose this. I'm a winner. Look at me. I've won all along. I'm going to win this one. And it was that sense of hubris that differed really, because he settled for too little. If he settled for a bit more, especially if he dragged on the negotiation a bit longer, walked out, thrown his toys out of the pram, I think he would have got more on freedom of movement.
And I think
that would have switched the balance.
Well, freedom of movement is, I think, the key.
For our readers, without a shadow of a doubt, you know, I'm absolutely, I know this. They did not vote on matters of sovereignty. I think that came into it. But they were angry with the status quo because they hadn't had a pay rise in 10 years. They saw the bankers, suddenly might be in this room, getting ever richer, but they weren't. So they were very angry with the system. But their single biggest motivating factor, without a shadow of a doubt, was immigration, freedom to control. The question was, what is the biggest threat to the PLC, Brexit or Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister, correct? Tricky one.
You've practiced, yeah.
Define Brexit. So, Brexit could mean a catastrophic hard Brexit, leaving without any deal whatsoever. I just explained I don't think it will, but a catastrophic, very hard Brexit would, in my view, precipitate a Jeremy Corbyn government anyway. But my personal views are a catastrophic hard Brexit could do more damage than a Jeremy Corbyn government. I don't think a Jeremy Corbyn government will end up doing anywhere near half the pretty hard left things that they profess they would want to do, simply because the system and the Labour Party and Labour MPs wouldn't let that happen. I personally don't think Jeremy Corbyn-led government would be very healthy for the country at all, but a hard Brexit would be guaranteed, in my view, as a catastrophic no-deal Brexit would be guaranteed, in my view, to plunge us into a negative growth and a recession. Jeremy Corbyn-led government might well do that, but I don't think we can say that with surety yet.
But with the Fixed Parliament Act, and is it 75% we need to get to a snap election, given the, put this tactfully, the history that we're told exists between the DUP and Jeremy Corbyn, do you not think actually it would never get through Parliament because the DUP would make sure Corbyn never got a crack at it?
Well, this is before a general election.
Yeah. In other words, you can't dissolve Parliament. You can't have a vote of no confidence and lose, and so we're stuck until 2022.
I think I agree with that. I think a general election any time before the current government's choosing is impractical. It would the baseline for Tory MPs and the DUP is we will literally take anything. I mean, their answer is very clear. Jeremy Corbyn, maybe Jacob Rees-Mogg might disagree, John Rimmer might disagree, but there are probably only five Tory MPs who generally think the state of Brexit is more important than keeping Jeremy Corbyn out. So Tory MPs are of the devout view that Jeremy Corbyn comes a lot, well, largely because they'd lose their jobs, certainly in government and maybe in Parliament as well. So they will do anything to prevent that. So without a shadow of doubt. And you need a, you know, you need a majority of MPs to cause a general election. And there, I can't think of a single actual Tory MP who would generally vote for a general election at the moment. Now, that's not to say that in the 2 or 3 months coming up, which would be, could end up being pretty incredible politically, and all sorts of connotations are possible. You could end up in a scenario, not will, would, that you would see a confidence vote placed by Theresa May on the final Brexit deal. Now, not a confidence vote in the Fixed Term Parliament Act means you can't, the Prime Minister can't go to the country whenever she wants anymore. She has to get a majority of both of the House of Commons, rather, to vote for a dissolution of Parliament. A no confidence vote in herself, basically. What she can do is put a confidence vote in her own leadership, which she, if she loses, she will then resign. I think it would be quite hard for a Tory Prime Minister, a new Tory Prime Minister, to govern with so much undecided, with so much at play, without going back to the people at some stage. And the pressure upon that new Tory leader to call it an election sooner or later would be enormous. They wouldn't have to, and they might still be able to live to 2022, but it would be, but by that stage, they've got no legitimacy to what type of Brexit they're about to deliver, and no personal legitimacy, which is a pretty hard thing for a government to wear. I mean, look at the trouble Gordon Brown had, you know, through the financial crisis, when everyone started pummeling him for never being elected by anybody, not even the Labour Party. So for those reasons, a general election is possible with a new Tory leader if you collapse Theresa May, but it might be still unlikely.
If May doesn't survive Brexit, who's likely to replace her?
Well, she won't survive. Are you putting a timeline on when she gets thrown out before the 29th of March?
Well, maybe it is.
I think it's almost impossible that she'll get thrown out before the 29th of March now, because that just isn't the time to elect a new Tory leader in time to deliver a different shape of Brexit, or any type of Brexit, quite frankly. If she goes before the 29th of March, you'll probably will end up looking probably some sort of caretaker figure who would have to say, I will be Prime Minister for 6 months to get us through this, and then we'll have a proper leadership contest. Jeremy Hunt is probably the most likely candidate. I mean, he's the least divisive, although he doesn't have his friends either, and I don't think he would win an outright Tory leadership contest at all. I don't think the Tory party would want to put him in front of the country as their leader at the next election, because he's so scarred having run the NHS for 6 years with, you know, public sector workers. But he would seem like the most sort of caretaker-ish at the moment. So a caretaker pre-29th, if she goes post-29th of March, that's a completely different ballgame, but that's not a question of asking, is it? Sorry?
Who could that be post-March?
Post-29th of March, I mean, she will go post-29th of March in reasonably short order, in my view. I don't think she'll get through next summer without having at least declared a leadership contest, and the fact she's standing down. Possibly by next Tory conference, and they'll run the leadership contest over the summer and then have a winner by Tory conference 2019. But I think, you know, she is into her last year as Prime Minister now, as reasonably certain. I think there are, it's wide open, is the honest answer. The field is enormous. A good 30 or so Tory MPs would try and run. I'd say 25 of them have got zero chance. There are 5 who've got a chance. I can't pin it down any more than that, really. So there would be Sajid Javid, who probably has the best chance, maybe 21%. Then Jeremy Hunt again. I don't think he'll do it there because of the public sector problem he's got. Then from the Brexiteer wing, Boris Johnson would definitely run, or would probably run, actually. I'm not sure that's definite, but he'd be the hard Brexiteers candidate. Dominic Raab would probably be the soft Brexiteers candidate, or the sort of the Vichy Brexiteers, as they're known as, the ones who haven't resigned from the government. And Ian Other, who would come, would be the dark horse from the 2015 intake.
You haven't mentioned Michael Gove.
No, he won't. I don't think he'll run. I think he's very unpopular with Tories for 2 reasons. First, because he's seen as disloyal, he stabbed Boris in the back, and Tory party members are generally loyal sorts, and they don't like that kind of perfidiousness. But also, the ones who do like him, which by the way aren't any Tory Remainers, the Tory Brexiteers, who don't mind the fact he stabbed Boris Johnson in the back, so that's about half of them gone, don't like him because he is backing Chequers, and they don't like Chequers very much at all. He's also not, I mean, he's a very interesting politician and a very interesting person, complex person, but I'm not sure he's massively voter friendly. You know, some say he looks a bit odd, some say he talks a bit odd, and I don't think he would be able to front up a Tory party into a, you know, a general election. The dark horse candidates from the 2015 intake are really interesting. Maybe a bit early for them, but it all depends when the leadership contest is. If it's in a year or two's time, they've got more of a chance. But the sort of, I'm thinking more like sort of, you know, the warrior leader model. So there's a good two or three ex-army officers who are brilliant, upcoming young talents, people like Tom Chubinart and Johnny Mercer. Highly impressive, maybe not quite ready, but you know, you never know. They've got to put some pretty impressive thinking together pretty quickly. But the idea of a whole new broom coming in, sweeping out all the rivalries and the factions and the backbiting and the bad blood that Brexit has exacerbated in the Tory party, and is basically the composition of the current cabinet, is hugely attractive to party members, I think, and also the wider British public. So a young dark horse is not in any way beyond the realms of contention, maybe.
I was going to ask you the question, we've almost answered it, but do you think there's a high probability of the current lot all out and skip to the next generation for the leader? Because I do know firsthand that that is a massively supportive view in the party on the ground. The question is, because we get to choose from two, would it get through Parliament to get them in front of the membership?
Well, that's a very good point and a very big problem. There was once a phrase coined, actually by someone very senior in my organisation, used by Gordon Brown to attack David Cameron during the height of the financial crisis and post that, which is, this is no time for a novice. It was probably the best line of attack Gordon had ever had on David Cameron. It came literally courtesy of my organisation. I won't say precisely, but it was a great line. And Cameron found this out and has never forgiven that person for giving Gordon Brown this line.
It doesn't send him text. Well, not ones that appear right there, right. You've had Simon Danzig, we spoke about his text.
Yes, yeah, that's another story altogether, poor old Simon Danzig. So, the disadvantage for the next generation, the new generation, the new broom, is quite clearly, Britain's in a bit of a pickle at the moment. This really is no time for novice, and that might, you know, come true. Or bear fruit.
But then Tony Blair came in with no experience, no getting
He'd led an opposition party for 3 years, as had Cameron for 5 years, and at least that gave them, the public and also party members, a sense of understanding of what they might be like, that they could run a successful political organisation, they could fight a successful general election campaign. The new guys, who in my view are brilliant, and could do a really good job, I wonder whether they'll be able to persuade party members of that. I mean, you know, they may.
But would there possibly be the risk as well, and the obvious one is William Hague, who was a mug, I remember saying at the time, to stand and become leader. He should have waited till it was all out of the way and then come back. Do you think they might be looking back to the Hague and thinking, actually, I'm going to stand back, let the mess free go?
No. Politicians are, if there's a faintest whiff of power, in my experience, there's a faintest whiff of power in the wind, they will try and grab it.
You're onto it.
Prematurely, the idea that the politician who sits around the colonies and I'll just buy my time. It's logical, but they don't exist.
But will Chequers get through Parliament and be accepted by the EU as the basis for Brexit? And if not, what then?
Just a simple one to finish
off. And the maths was in the in the Guardian a couple of days ago. They did all the maths on which side, and they didn't reach a conclusion.
No, we've all been having a go at the maths for really ever since the general election last year, or the day after general election last year. I mean, look, that is A, will Chequers pass? B, what happens if it doesn't? Is the two biggest unknowns, not just in British politics, but certainly the secondary one of those, possibly British politics of all time, because we literally enter an era of British politics that is totally unprecedented, a place we've never been before, where there is this total constitutional crisis of what happens if the plan doesn't work. You know, second referendum, delay Brexit, go ahead with it anyway. We haven't done this before, so there's no precedent for me to give a barometer for. I can give you my best guess, but please don't hold me to that, because you know, anything, with the caveat that anything could happen in British politics over the next 3 months, literally anything, including, although I think it's unlikely, a general election. Chequers, as it looks at the moment, as it's written down in the government's white paper as a result of the debate in Chequers on that day in July, won't pass through the House of Commons, because it won't look like that by the time the EU finish with it. What I think is far more likely is a fudge will develop, what is becoming commonly known as a blind Brexit. So the EU will not be able to agree with Theresa May on any hard set of facts in terms of what the future relationship looks like. The EU definitely want the withdrawal agreement, as in the Brexit bill and the like, to pass. So they will conspire with Theresa May to come up with a fudge, a nice sounding language, which both sides can agree might be enough to pass through the House of Commons. That's then a big if Tory Brexiteers block that because they don't want to give away £39 billion for a load of vague sounding nice words. So we then go into literally the what if, and there are huge amounts of calculations with that. Fudge. The EU, I think, will want to be honest, I don't know what this all begins tomorrow, by the way, at Salzburg. Two things could happen at Salzburg. The EU could signal that they're ready to cut a vague deal, a fudge, with Theresa May, and then we'll get a fudge that's reasonably meaningless, and this is all kicked into, you know, post-Brexit. Or, and this is, you know, I still think quite likely, the EU could squeeze us until the pips squeak. So, you know, again, we were having this debate a bit earlier. I had lunch with an EU ambassador, one of the EU nations invited me to lunch in their Belgrave Square mansion. I tell you what, Belgrave Square, I didn't know this around recently, but all the EU ambassadors are based on this big publicity push, trying to talk around the likes of me into why the government needed to get its act together on Brexit, needing to stop backing Brexit with the strongest we're backing it. So they've all invited us for these lunches and breakfasts, but they own almost the entirety of Belgrave Square. It's quite extraordinary. But this EU ambassador, I won't say which it was, but he made a really interesting point to me, which is, you know, why do you not think we're going to give in just because you threaten us with the collapse of Theresa May's government? To which I said, well, of course you're going to give in. You don't want pandemonium, you don't want general election, you don't want to deal with Jeremy Corbyn, do you? To which this ambassador said to me, why wouldn't we? What is it that Jeremy Corbyn is offering us in terms of Brexit that's any worse than you're offering us? And I suddenly realised, my God, our baseline in modern-day British politics is no one's going to want to cause a general election. No one's going to want to bring down the government. Not the Brexiteers, not the Remainers. Half the Labour Party don't want that either, and definitely not the EU. Actually, the EU might want to bring down the government, or they might not be too bothered if the government falls, because in their view, that is the best possible way. I'm not saying this is true, but I think it's a likelihood. That's the best possible way for encouraging les autres. In other words, to tell anyone else who wants to leave the EU, look what happens if you try, you implode into total chaos. So it could be the EU actually push Theresa May all the way on this, don't give her any deal whatsoever, and create utter pandemonium, which results in all forms of utter chaos. So that's why I'm not trying to avoid the answer or give you a prediction, but there are huge amounts there are the Rumsfeldian and known unknowns, but also the unknown unknowns, and it is the hardest possible time to make a prediction, because there are so many different computations that can happen.